And I want to turn now to Alex Jones. He's the director of the Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. At the end of the school year, he'll step down from that post after 15 years. He won a Pulitzer Prize covering the press for the New York Times, and he's with us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Anthony. Glad
to
be here.
Well, as you know, we asked you to come in to talk about your 15 years at the Shorenstein Center and your views on the state of journalism in the digital age. But let's start with this news this week. Your reaction to this push for net neutrality and what you just heard Senator Markey talking about.
I agree with Senator Markey pretty much right down the line. I think it really is a matter. The way to think about it sort of in an abstract way is think about what the First Amendment protects. The First Amendment doesn't protect popular speech. The First Amendment protects unpopular speech. I think the whole idea of regulation in this kind of context is supporting the little guys, is making the little guys have a shot, and basically making it impossible, or unlikely anyway, that the barons, as he calls them, are going to be in the position forever and ever, amen. I think this really opens up the idea of what he called paranoid competition. I think that, you know, that may be the right way to think of it. And I think that the big guys, the Comcast, the Googles, and so forth, are paranoid.
Yeah, really interesting. It took a long time, nearly a decade, for a bunch of people to come around to this idea of net neutrality. From the reading that I've done, it doesn't sound like FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler had always been on board, but he certainly got there.
Well, I think you remember, we're like 25 years into the World Wide Web, which really made it wide open. And so when Google started, Google was a startup. And so their idea about what the net should be would have been, I think, very different if they were starting up today. I think basically what we didn't expect that these behemoths would grow so quickly and so be so dominant. And what I think we want to make sure of is that it's not a stasis, it's not frozen in amber, and that we don't create something that isn't dynamic in a competitive sense.
Well, let me sort of shift this conversation and sort of begin this broader conversation about where we are in this digital age. And I'd love to sort of pick your brain a little bit about this. You've said that we're in the midst of a Gutenberg moment in terms of digital technology in the press. And you're referring, of course, to the printing press, which represented this huge technological leap, but it was also destabilizing in very dramatic ways.
It was extremely destabilizing and in counterintuitive ways in some respects. First of all, it blew the existing economic model, which at that time was copying things by hand, basically, completely destroyed that. And I think that's what the newspaper industry and other sort of traditional media are now trying to figure out a way to cope with, because this is a gigantic change and it upsets the economic model. But the point is, the Gutenberg inventions, and there were several of them, when they escaped into the world, they changed everything. They didn't just change the printing business or the communications business. They changed politics, science, education, every institution. They did it over a relatively long period of time. When I say a long period of time, I mean, when you talk about Gutenberg, people tend to think enlightenment, democracy. That's not the way it worked. What came first was, the wars between the Protestants and the Catholics, the Inquisition. One of the counterintuitive things about what happened was about science. At the time of Gutenberg's invention, 1450, the scientists who were on the breaking, frontier of science at that time communicated with each other in Latin. They all lived, and we're talking about Europe now. They were from different parts of Europe, but the common language was Latin. And they sort of disparaged this new technology because it tended to do what it did in the vernacular, in French and German and English and Spanish and so forth. So they sort of shunned it. The people who seized it were the pseudoscientists and the hacks and the people who were selling superstitions and all kinds of baloney, but they seized the technology and used it to spread their ideas. Right now, I would say we've got a very similar situation in some respects. We're probably, as a nation certainly, maybe not as a world, but as a nation, stupider about global warming than we were 20 years ago. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that this technology has made it possible for people who have ideas that may not be rooted in science to communicate them very effectively and very efficiently, cheaply, for nothing, in a way that makes the technology serve not necessarily a good end.
Right. So, I mean, to go back to this idea of the Gutenberg moment, I mean, sort of after all of these centuries, you know, I think we can all agree that the development of the press, like, it was a good thing. It we're better off for it. Do you think eventually this sort of digital shakedown is going to be?
Of course. I think the issue for us is we're living through something, right?
Right.
It reminds me of when the bombing took place and they were shut down Cambridge to search for the killers. We were watching it on CNN, listening to it on radio, and living through it simultaneously. And that's what we're doing now. We're living in the first blush of something that's going to change everything eventually. And probably, you know, 100 years from now, 100 years doesn't seem like a long time when you're looking at 500 years in Gutenberg's context. For us, it looks like a long time. And the speed with which things are going makes that, you know, who knows what's going to come. But the point of the Gutenberg prototype is that it allows us to look at what we're going through now through the prism of what happened then, and most critically, to try to preserve the institutions and the values that we want to, you know, be projected into this new world.
Yeah.
Do we want to throw the baby out with the bathwater?
And what's your biggest concern about that? I mean, what direction would this go in if it went in a truly awful direction?
As far as I'm concerned, I'm a media guy, I'm a news guy. I think if we lost the ability to engage a younger generation in serious news, it will be a tragedy for our country and for our democracy. And I think that one of the things that's happened very quickly is that the values of the web have pretty much trumped the traditional values that were in place even in 2000 when I came to the Shorenstein Center. The idea of speed has trumped accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of edge and voice have trumped fairness and a kind of balance. And more than anything, the cardinal demand of digital technology is that it be entertaining. That, I think, is something that is the world we live in now. And if you try to pretend that it isn't, you're kidding yourself. But how do we adapt that world to the parallel need for people to have reliable, reported, factual information upon which to make the opinions that they need to make to be functioning successfully, anyway, in a democracy?
Yeah, it's ironic, isn't it? I mean, because we're living at a time when anyone can pretty much report and get online and say pretty much anything they want, and yet certain kinds of information that are really useful to the functioning of our democracy, for example, coverage of state houses, is diminished.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, this has to do with the economic model being blown up.
Right.
And I think that newspapers did most of that work, and they've been, of course, hammered by this because they lost their classified advertising for cars and houses and so forth. I mean, this is an old story, and we have not solved the question or the riddle of how you find an economic model that will support people who are willing to go out and spend their lives and make a career out of doing serious journalistic work and then deliver it in a way that people will consume.
Yeah. You've also talked about the two extremes on the net, the idea that anything can be said and that nothing can be said. And we talked about the anything can be said, the nothing can be said exemplified by the Charlie Hebdo massacre as an example. That is, you know, you can be massacred for essentially doing journalism.
Well, you can, and I think that we live in a world in which violence, you know, the thing that's so horrific about the thing that have been going on with ISIS and some of these kind of brutal terrorist acts is that they seem so out of place in the 21st century. But in fact, they are very effective. And I think that the way the media have reacted has been very interesting. I think it has prompted a genuinely serious conversation that's appropriate about how far is too far and what can you say and what can't you say. We live in a world here in the United States, in Boston, where there are things you can't say. If you were sitting over here and making racist comments and so forth like that, you would not have this job.
Right.
And I think the thing is that you want to preserve as much free speech as you can while recognizing that there are limits. And how we solve that problem is, again, a difficult one. But it's going to have to be addressed, because otherwise, if we have everything said, then it's going to cheapen discourse completely. And if we have, on the other hand, if we cede power to decide what should be said to government, for instance, that won't work.
Yeah. I want to ask you about something. This is a little bit of change of direction, but this is just sort of recent news. But it struck me, and we were talking about it in the newsroom this morning, and that is this story about Brian Williams, the news anchor for NBC, admitted yesterday that he'd lied about a war story he's apparently been telling for years about being in a helicopter that was shot down in Iraq. Turned out he wasn't in that helicopter. He was in another helicopter. And he sort of described it as it was just a dumb mistake and a clumsy effort to pay honor to a brave veteran. But I don't want to dwell too much on this, but it seems like another blow to the credibility of network news. What's your response to that?
Well, I don't know what it says about network news, but I think it's a real blow to Brian Williams.
Yeah.
And I feel terrible for him because I think he's an honorable man. But I think this is not unlike somebody who puts something fake on their resume and claims a degree they didn't get or something else. This was a story that was a story that, you know, inflated his stature.
Right.
And he told it as recently as last week. I mean, apparently that was what got him in such trouble. He told it, and the people who were there basically said, no way, this is not what happened. I think that it's a real problem, and yeah. I think that he...
But is it a problem for NBC? I mean, to what extent does it reflect
on... I think the degree to which it is a problem for NBC is what they do about it.
Yeah.
I don't think they've done anything about it yet.
Yeah, right. Well, there's a lot more I want to talk to you about. I want to give you a chance to talk very quickly about... listeners may recall that you've got a sort of big piece of public radio on your resume. You used to host On the Media.
I was the first host for On the Media.
Well, that's right. Yeah.
When it was located at WNYC and before it went on NPR, but it was syndicated anyway, and WBUR, I'm proud to say, was one of the places that carried it.
Yeah. So tell me a story about those early days.
Well, I'm a newspaper guy. You know, I was at the New York Times. I was not at the New York Times because I'd left to write a book. And I got the opportunity to apply or to try out, really, for this live show on media. And I'd never done radio. So I went out, and I didn't know enough to know that doing live radio is terrifying to a lot of people. didn't bother me because I'd been used to talking to people, interviewing them, and so forth. Anyway, I'm on the air one of the first two or three weeks I did it. And my guest was Tina Brown. And as you know,
editor of the New Yorker,
at that time. And we're sitting here in a studio and we've got headphones on. Well, the headphones are your lifeline when you're in radio. And shortly before a break came up, my headphones went out.
Uh-oh.
And I didn't know I didn't know what had happened.
And just for listeners to understand, your lifeline, because the folks in the studio can talk to you and tell you where to go and what to do and sometimes what to say.
And you don't know, for one thing, you don't know whether you're actually going out or not. You don't know whether there's been a power failure. You don't know what has happened. And I thought, this is my opportunity to show how cool I can be under pressure. So my headphones go out. I don't know what's happening. We're coming up on a break. And I said, with as much coolness and suavity as I could muster, stick with us. We're going to have a break. We'll be right back with Tina Turner.
That's great.
When I got home, my wife asked me about the Iquettes.
Great story. Well, Alex Jones, the suave and always in control Alex Jones, thank you for coming in today. We really appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
That's Alex Jones. He's the director of the Shorenstein Center on Media Politics and Public Policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. He'll be stepping down in July again. Thank you, Alex. And we'll have to get you back to find out what you're going to be doing next, but that's going to be another conversation.
Great. Thanks,
all right. Stay with us. Coming up, the debate over adding fluoride to public water. Health experts say it's been helping us for the past 7 decades, so why are people still opposed to it? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.